The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So this morning I would like to talk about desire. Desire is one of the key topics for Buddhist practitioners to become wise about. And it occurred to me as a topic for today because I had a series of conversations with people over the last week or two where desire seemed to be the character of their way of being in the world. It's just that they're filled with desires, and so much so that sometimes it's invisible that there's so many desires operating. And it reminded me these conversations of when I was about 20 or 21. I'd just begun my Buddhist practice, or just was interested in it at that point. And I was interested in many other things as well. And I was hitchhiking, and I was picked up by a driver. And the driver was asking me about myself. And I went through and started telling him the different things that I wanted to do. I wanted to study Zen Buddhism. I wanted to study Sufism. I wanted to do Aikido. I wanted to become a farmer. And that's all I remember, but there was a long list. So I was just kind of, matter-of-factly telling, like, this is the most ordinary thing in the world, to have these desires. And at some point, he looked at me and he said, "You have a lot of desires." And that was like, "What? Really?" And that was kind of a wake-up for me that this was a topic to explore, to understand better about way of understanding myself. And it's been a fascinating exploration ever since. I think it's important to not think that Buddhist practice is anti-desire. It's fairly common for people to pick up some idea, and that's in the general culture, that Buddhism says desire is the cause of suffering. And Buddhism, and the Buddha and Buddhism never says that, but always specifies a particular kind of desire, which is the cause, the condition for the arising of suffering. And I'll get to that a little bit later. But Buddhism is not anti-desire, and it's not doesn't have like a policy like you should suppress desire or get rid of desire. I think the more fundamental relationship with desire is to explore it, to investigate it, to become wise about how desire works in you. And for that to happen, you have to kind of take some time to stop and look and consider how desires work in your life, all the different kinds of desires, and get sensitive to how they function in all kinds of circumstances. What you'll find probably is desires are a very, very frequent part of life, and they operate in very subtle levels. Even shifting your position in the chair as you're sitting is a kind of desire that if you don't shift your posture, sometimes the desire fades away, and sometimes it builds and gets stronger and you feel different aspects and strengths of the desire. But some of these desires, like shifting your position in the chair, is just so natural, so intuitive, so common that it doesn't even occur to us that it's a desire because it's just shifting our posture. But they're quite common in life. So there's small desires, little ones, and there's huge desires that consume us. And we spend a lot of time exploring and understanding. So in Buddhism, we want to really understand and be wise about desires. And one of the places, one of the arenas for developing wisdom is meditation. And meditation gives a particular perspective or new perspectives on desire that are often not so available in daily life. And so to sit quietly and be in a situation where you're not going to act on most of your desires. Desires can come and sit when you meditate, but for the period of time that you're committed to sitting quietly and not moving, more or less not moving, that this is not the time you're going to act on any of them. And so some of the desires we have that are somewhat automatic, that we follow automatically, we don't follow. So for example, you could be sitting quietly and want to shift your attention, shift your posture. It can be innocent and appropriate to do that. But But you know, it might not be necessary to do that. And the idea in meditation is not to shift your posture easily, sit still. And so you get to see that there's a desire to shift, and you see, I don't need to. I can just stay here, and I don't have to act on that. Or you can act on it, and you can see that in acting on it, it actually very subtly agitates the mind. Or very subtly, I've done this in meditation, where I thought, I have to shift my posture. And I shift it, and lo and behold, 2 seconds later, no, I think I need to shift it again. Do it again. You know, I think I need to shift. And it kind of like there's this chain reaction of desires. I get caught up in the stream of them. But if I sit still and don't give in to that simple desire, it fades away and doesn't kind of enter kind of a chain of one desire leading to another. So there can be other desires that arise in meditation. But you're not going to act on them, so we get to look at them. What is this desire? Can I understand it in a different way? What happens when I get involved in a strong desire? How in touch am I with myself? And again, the vantage point of meditation is that it's a place where we're supposed to kind of find a way to connect more deeply with our lived, direct experience, a direct contact with ourselves, physically, emotionally, psychologically, just really be connected, present here for what's going on. As the mind gets pulled into a desire, generally desires will come with thinking. And we have thoughts and images about what we want and what we're going to get it, and planning come into play perhaps. And certain desires, as we get pulled into that world, universe of the desire, you can start feeling how you've lost a connection with yourself. You're kind of in the world of fantasy or in imagination or in the world of planning or something. And so is that really the best use of your time in meditation? It was satisfying to be connected to yourself. And some desires are satisfying because they have so much promise, the allure of the promise. But you know, compared to the sense of being fully embodied, feeling full and present and contented here, it feels kind of pale or kind of empty to be in this world of desire one more time. And so that we learn something about desire, about the relationship it has with that, what happens with desire and our connection to ourselves. It doesn't condemn desire. What it does is it enhances an appreciation for our life in a different way than comes from being pulled into the world of desire. So that's kind of an example of wisdom coming into play. Could also understand that when desire starts operating, you're sitting meditating and you're not moving, and maybe you have some modicum of being relaxed, and you can notice that as strong desire arises, that there's like strings from the desire to your muscles, and you know you're like a puppet, and the desires are the puppet master, and they start pulling and tugging on different muscles, and you start getting tense, you start feeling tight, you start feeling like you're pulling back or leaning forward. Different muscles could be in your forehead, your eyes, the jaws, the chest, the arms, the hands. It can be at stomach, it can be anywhere. You start feeling the physical consequences of having a desire. It's also possible to notice the energetic cost of having a strong desire. You're pulled into it, especially people who meditate like on a retreat where you're doing a lot of it. And sometimes people get pulled into a world of desire for several sittings, several meditations in a row, believe it or not. Those of you who've been on retreat will believe it. And after a while, you can start seeing that it's actually kind of debilitating for the mind. It's tiring for the mind. It's kind of exhausting. Even a really good desire. One of the common desires that occasionally some people have had in human history, in meditation, is sexual desires. And they have sexual fantasies. And it's not uncommon for people, especially on retreat, but after some time, where just this begins, you know, it had a certain pleasure, a certain kind of promise, a certain kind of fantasy world, that I felt so good and contented and happy or something. But after a while, not only does it physically feel kind of debilitating and disconnecting to, you know, the fullness of our being here to be in that desire, but it's actually tiring. The mind gets tired. Kind of the same way that it gets maybe tired from like caffeine. Caffeine can get you going, But it's at a cost. And so either you have to keep pumping yourself up or you come down and crash. So sometimes being caught into the world of fantasy can be that way too. And actually some people use fantasy, use desire to keep themselves energized, because if they don't, they're afraid of feeling what's there instead. They're afraid of being tired. They're afraid of feeling the underlying emotions. And that's the other thing to study when we're studying desires. And that is, what is it that's prompting the desires? What's the underlying condition or situation that's pulling them forward? I'm fond of the English word wanting because of its double meaning. Wanting can mean desiring. But we also use this English word sometimes that the soup is wanting salt. It kind of means that it desires salt, but it also has the implication of being it's lacking salt. And so sometimes a sense of lack or a kind of emptiness inside can feel like, oh, I feel so empty, I want something to fill me. And we search out. Some people fill it with food. They're depressed or sad or something, and they fill themselves with food, or they fill themselves with entertainment. But that movement towards desire for the food, the desire for the entertainment, is a movement away from feeling uncomfortable inside. And so how often does desire operate as an avoidance mechanism? We're trying to avoid feeling what's uncomfortable. Now, it can be reasonable, you know, policy, reasonable not to want to be uncomfortable, and so to look for a solution for our discomfort. But what sometimes desire operates, can operate as not a real, genuine solution to discomfort, but rather take us away from ourselves again, cover it over. It doesn't really help resolve the underlying condition. It kind of moves us away from it and keeps us at a distance from it. It's kind of like a distraction from it. And so again, in meditation, the commitment or the idea in meditation is to keep coming back and experiencing what's here. And so you let go of the desire in order to be here in meditation. And then I feel sad. I feel uncomfortable. I feel empty in some way. And I guess I have to face this now, rather than recoiling from it or going out from it. And so meditation then becomes a time to begin understanding the underlying conditions of desire. It doesn't. Some desires are beautiful desires, and they might arise out of compassion and care. And so meditation, if that's the case, it's more, I think, powerful to come back into the realm of compassion that we're feeling than it is to be in the planning mode about how I'm going to act on that compassion. I want to be real compassionate. I want to be a Buddhist chaplain, and I'm going to be great, and it'll be wonderful. I'll go to the spiritual symposium on Saturday, and you know, it'll just be so wonderful, and it's the beginning of a new life for me, and you know, and the mind carries off, and it's pretty soon you're disconnected again from yourself, even though it sounds like real grand. And so then you come back and begin with this beautiful kind of feeling of compassion and care. So what happens if you just feel that directly? So to study desire also becomes a studying of the underlying conditions for it, the motivations for it. And some of those things that are underneath it, the desire that prompted it, are really deserving of careful attention, exploration, being present for. And we miss it sometimes if we act on our desires too quickly. So come back. So there are desires of things that we want, and there's a kind of desires of things that we don't want. I want that thing to go away. I want not to have that experience. So it's both kind of approach desires and avoidance desires, sometimes called. Both are kind of desires. And so to understand them and to explore them is a wonderful thing to do in meditation. One of the also advantages of meditation is that it's possible to discover a kind of contentment or peace which is unconditioned, and which is meaning in Buddhism that it's not dependent on getting something to make you happy. The desire for happiness is a great desire. But we have to look at what are we expecting is going to make us happy. So what is it? So is it a desire for something, or is it a desire for unconditioned happiness? So if we want to be happy, and we think how we're going to be happy is winning the California lottery, then you should probably, you know, start investing all your money on lottery tickets and hope that you win something before your bank account goes empty. So good luck. So, you know, how much of our desires are looking towards something to make us happy, some person to make us happy, some event to make us happy. And so there's nothing inherently wrong with that. But if we put all our eggs in the basket of something outside of us is going to make us happy, then we're always going to be searching. We're always going to be looking for something else, because it can't really be permanent, the things in the world that are constantly shifting and are permanent in terms of creating happiness. But meditation is a fantastic place, because we're sitting quietly doing nothing, to discover what it's like to be at peace with this moment, to be at ease and feel some kind of happiness we're just here. And that's why even in meditation, we have to get wise about the desires we have about meditation. It's possible to desire something in meditation. I want to get concentrated. I want to get happy. I want to be peaceful. That desire itself can trip one up when we're meditating. It can be innocent desire, it can be an appropriate desire to have, and you sit down with that desire, but it's fine. But then when you sit down to meditate, the desire to be happy while you're meditating is so strong that you're kind of like searching for the happiness, you're kind of trying to fix everything, manipulate, you're trying, if I just shift my posture this way, if I can just focus my breath this way, and if I can just understand myself, and I'll just keep analyzing my mind, where's the problem, where's the button I have to push in order to be happy? And we're just like searching and doing and evaluating and judging what's going on. And that very desire is interfering with letting go and discovering a natural capacity for happiness and well-being that can well up from the inside when we have no reason to be happy. And this, I think, is one of the miracles of something like meditation, that the human heart, the human being, has the capacity for happiness, for no reason. And you can sit there quietly, minding your own business, mostly letting go of desires, letting go of trying to do anything else, to find some way to be content with what you have in the moment, the conditions are here, and discover you can be quite at peace. And that peacefulness, there's a kind of contentment or happiness or well-being. In fact, some of the most satisfying and strongest happinesses that human beings can experience are the kind of happiness that comes from a deep letting go and a deep kind of contentment and ease with just being here with what is, rather than getting something and having something. And people who have, you know, some high quality sense of meditative happiness puts other kinds of happiness in a different context. So, for example, there are wonderful happinesses to have in the world for good reasons. You can have great success with some endeavor that you've spent a lot of time pursuing. You can have a wonderful time with a friend. You can, you know, have some wonderful form of entertainment that makes you laugh and feel very happy. They're wonderful things, and I don't want to in any kind of way dismiss them as being unimportant. But there's a way in which many kinds of worldly happinesses involve a kind of energetic quality of the mind that is not very settled and peaceful. And so that it gets kind of tiring after a while. And people have to take a nap after a while, you know, like, wow, you know, especially if we get older. You know, that was good, but you know, check with me in 3 hours. But the happiness of something like meditation, this unconditional happiness of just being, doesn't involve the energetic quality of the mind excited and thinking and kind of searching and engaged. And so it's much more sustainable. In fact, it can be refreshing and reviving. to have this. So what I hope you get the sense for here is that meditation can be a laboratory, not to come to final conclusions, you know, like or judgments about desire, but rather to have the capacity to evaluate and study, to be wise about desires. So when desires arise in your life, you're prepared to understand them. You're prepared to investigate and see, what kind of desire is this? How is this operating right now? What effect does it have on me to get involved in this desire? Is there a way of relating to this desire which nourishes me? Or is there a way of relating to this desire which drains me? And in fact, there can be healthy desires, appropriate desires to have. The way that we relate to the desire is draining. We're so wanted so much, we're kind of so straining, we're so critical of ourselves for not getting it, we're so like, you know, trying to manipulate the situation that, it's harmful to us to have a healthy desire. It's the how we are with the desire. So we have wisdom about the how we are with it. We have wisdom about the purpose we have for desire. What are we pursuing with our desire? Is this really for our ultimate benefit? Are we expecting too much from a desire that we have, too much promise, that we think this is going to be the solution to it all, and then when we get it, we know it's not as satisfying as we thought? And do we have access to a kind of happiness, well-being, and peace that is not dependent on having the desire fulfilled? Because then our relationship to the desire can be much more easeful, light, relaxed. We can kind of like take it or leave it. Yes, it's a good desire. Yes, I think I'll pursue this desire. But you know, if the things change and make it difficult, or there's too many obstacles, or my baby's crying, and the baby needs me, so I think, you know, I can let go of, you know, watching my favorite TV show or going for one more snack, or because I think I'll go take care of the baby. You know, so whatever the world presents, we kind of respond appropriately. So a very interesting distinction that to desire, kind of alternative to desire, is preferences. Rather than operating on desires, operate on preferences. And the distinction for me, how I use those terms, is that a preference is not something we have to act on. A preference is something that we have a preference, we prefer one way or the other, and if the circumstances allow it, we can follow our preferences. If it's appropriate for the circumstances, then we can follow that preference. But we're not demanding it, that this be this way. Desires, some desires are compulsive. Some desires we can't put down. And this is the kind of desire that Buddhism is most concerned about. And the word that the word for the problematic kind of desire that the Buddha used is literally the ancient word means thirst. And so, when you're thirsty, there's a kind of sense of compulsion, very compelling feeling. The more thirsty you are, the more compelling it is. I want to drink. I have to drink. Get out of my way. I have to drink. You know, if it was a really hot day and you were working hard outside in the sun and you were just like really, really thirsty and there's a crowd of people between you and the water fountain, get out of my way. you force your way in because you're so desperate. So the idea of being of thirst, and so the kind of desire that Buddhism is most concerned about freeing ourselves from is the desire which is compulsive. Or in modern parlance, when we're driven by a desire. Because when there's compulsion or drivenness, there's no freedom. And if there's no freedom, then there's a loss of connection to ourselves and some depth. And freedom is a place, when we're really free, we're really at home and connected, at peace, here with ourselves. When there's compulsion in the desire, addiction and the desire, then there's a way in which we lose ourselves. And the odd things about losing ourselves is that it's uncomfortable to not be in touch. And so if we're uncomfortable and we want to deal with that uncomfortable, then there's desire to deal with it. If we don't know, have a healthy way of dealing with the desire, then if we have the old habits, we go fall back on the old habits. Food, sex, entertainment, you know, changing the world, doing something out there. And if we fall back into desires, so if desire makes us disconnected, we're uncomfortable, so we look for desires to feel comfortable again, but the very desires we do are more desires that disconnect us even more. It becomes a chain reaction of desires which takes us further and further away from ourselves or keeps us disconnected. This is why to learn to have the ability to turn back on yourself when you're uncomfortable, to learn to be comfortable with discomfort, is one of the great benefits of something like meditation. And you should look for opportunities in meditation to be uncomfortable. I'll say it differently, more carefully. What I mean by that is, if it should happen one day that you're uncomfortable while you're meditating, think of it, that's a great opportunity. Great, finally, I'm uncomfortable. Finally. And now I get to learn to sit with that, to see how can I be comfortable with the discomfort? What kind of desires operate when I'm uncomfortable? How do I relate to those desires? How do those desires take me away or make me more uncomfortable? Are there desires which are the desires underneath the discomfort, which is the very cause for the discomfort? Sit with discomfort, feel the discomfort, and see if you can breathe with it and relax in it, feel it, and learn how to be at peace with it, and see what deeper and deeper connection you get as a result. So this is the way into ourselves, into peace, rather than out of ourselves, away from ourselves. So the desires that connect, and then following a way that helps us connect, versus desires that get us to disconnect, or get us kind of somehow, or desires which we lose, our freedom, the desires which are compulsive, driven. So I encourage you to become students of desire, and be very careful about any simple policy about desire, like desires are bad, or the opposite, all my desires are good, get out of my way, whatever I want is okay. But just study, look at them, get to know them. And if you're brave enough, as you learn about your desires and how they work for you, find a trusted friend or trusted a total stranger who would never see you again and discuss with them what you're learning about desire. Something very helpful happens sometimes when we're in conversation with other people and we hear ourselves speak about what we're learning about ourselves. So those are my thoughts for today. And we have about 10 minutes. And do you have any questions, concerns, or testimonials about what you've learned about desire? Don't tell me I was talking to people who already have desires well understood and no concerns about them.
When you watch desire, like even in the meditation, and you have to stay confined to your one little box there, like you're sitting on, and you're not used to doing that, and you have to sit there for 18 hours in that one little box, and then and you watch your desire to move or go somewhere else or do something else, then you start realizing we think desire is our escape for boredom, I guess.
Escape sometimes.
That we cannot sit still because we cannot be comfortable with ourselves if we're still. So we try to be in continuous motion to feel that boredom, but there's not really any boredom there, that the boredom is really a fabrication of the mind that we have invented. And if we can relax long enough and not to chase after the craving to get out of our box, then we can start to see the fabrication of the mind that has invented that we have to be in a state of motion with our mind, and that, you know, that we can actually be still.
Perfect.
I think you start seeing that.
Yeah, perfect. Great. Wonderful statement. I agree.
I was amazed at how many desires came up in this sitting, and I'm much more aware now of them as desire. The movement, desire to move, and so many little things. But bringing them to awareness through this talk, I think, is really helpful for me ongoing. Thank you.
Great, thank you. Behind you.
Hi. So I have a testimonial. And there have been several times while sitting on retreat, all these desires, you know, you name it, from sexual, food, intellectual, everything, resting, everything, they have come up. And it is hard. It is hard to stay still and feeling that urge, feeling that wanting, that, it starts, you know, like in a very benign way, you know, via an image or through a memory, there are physical sensations or physical sensations arising. And then it starts growing and growing and growing. And then that feeling of having a great fantasy and having a pleasant feeling starts changing. It started changing in some of the experiences I have had on retreat. And then they have become like aversive. You know, there's so much food or so much time thinking about the same thing that it has become tiring and really a big impact in the body. I'm glad to say that I feel grateful for some of those experiences and that some of them have been a boost of confidence.
In what way?
Well, I was able, you know, there was faith and confidence, you know, in the practice, in stay still, in staying still, and looking at the desire, and at some point really receiving from the practice kind of a shift in how to relate to the desire, taking responsibility for it. Seeing how I have planted the seeds of increasing the desire and keeping it as a fantasy or taking responsibility for it.
Nice.
So, nice. Thank you.
So it's wonderful to have confidence in something besides desire. Some people have a lot of confidence in desire. Great. Someone else?
Yeah. Just to piggyback on that, what is the benefit of sitting in that and getting to see what is the feeling underneath that? When you feel enslaved and you feel tortured and hurt by your own incapacity to release yourself. Mm-hmm. When that finally happens, that's such an incredible feeling of, oh, that's what's going on. Now I understand how my mind is working.
So you're saying that sometimes it's worthwhile hanging in there in the fire?
Oh, for sure.
And so, but sometimes, how long do you have to be in the fire?
Well, that depends how hard you're holding on, right? How imperative whatever has come up for you seems to be.
So sometimes it can be minutes, but sometimes it can be years?
Years, for sure. Certainly on retreat is a good opportunity to really see that.
Great. Thank you, Abraham.
Yeah.
So here for Barry.
I'd like to hear your thoughts on the desire to understand, because I can really get wrapped up in that.
Yeah. Well, in some ways, I've encouraged you to be interested and have some desire to understand desire, right? So desire to understand desire. So it can be healthy and helpful, but that desire to understand can also be driven, it can be compulsive. It can be done in such a way that it takes us out of ourselves and away from ourselves and it's a distraction from a deeper abiding, deeper sense of connectedness. And especially with the understanding, it can be intellectual. So it can take us into our head and thoughts and analysis. And so if you study that and see that, you see that it is a kind of disconnect. It can be very satisfying to be in the head. Understanding can be very meaningful. Even the pursuit of understanding can be very satisfying to do. It's not wrong in and of itself, but to be caught in the pull of it, and to only have that, the only means in which we're living our lives, again, doesn't allow for some deeper wellspring of connection. So I like to think of understanding to be not of the mind, but of the heart. And so when does the heart understand? And what does the heart want, as opposed to what the mind wants?
Thank you.
Great. Okay. So one more, and then if you think my answer can be quick. Okay, well, you can ask me afterwards. Is that okay? Because we have a... I just wanted to say that we're about to have our Sunday morning tea, which is a little bit of a social time to hang out and talk. And we still have 2 minutes before the official ending. So maybe you'll have some patience. Well, I do the thing I often do, is if you could, it'd be really nice if you, in a moment, turn towards the person near you and said hello, welcome them to IMC, and even if this is your very first, even this is your very first time here, you can welcome other people who've been here. And then if you care, you can say something about what you've learned in your life about desire.